Okay, so we've heard already several talks introducing this subject, the excellent talks by Kathy Clark in particular and Bruce Elmagreen, other speakers on Monday, earlier speakers today. So there's no point in me trying to give a comprehensive talk on this subject, even if I could. And what I'd like to do, since I'm coming late in the meeting here, is to pick out some selective topics, I think, relevant to this broader issue of the formation and disruption of star clusters that have arisen earlier in the meeting, and make some comments on these, partly with the idea of inciting some discussion after the talk. Now, let me begin this talk by focusing on this diagram here. This is the mass function of star clusters on the top in the antennae galaxies. These are young, you've seen this before. On the bottom, the globular clusters in the Milky Way, these are old objects. And in this representation, what's plotted is the log of the number of objects per unit log mass. And I think this is a very revealing diagram. If we want to understand the physics, rather than, say, the civil engineering of globular cluster formation, then I think we have to look at something like this. This, I think, is going to give us the greatest insight into understanding the physics of the globular cluster formation and disruption processes. One of the reasons for that is that if you take a stellar system, a bound stellar system, and put it in the tidal field of the parent galaxy, then for a given mass, many of the other properties of the cluster are determined to first order, its sizes, the way it evolves, the rate at which it relaxes, and many of these other sorts of problems. So the main quantity we have to understand is why certain number of clusters formed with this mass, this particular mass, and not some other mass. Now, it's useful to look at the example of the young clusters, the merging galaxies. Many people think these are young globular clusters, and compare them with this here. And clearly the first thing you see is that they're unquestionably very different functions. This one falls downward monotonically, this one rises up and then turns over. And what I'd like to do is just discuss briefly some of the features of these things and how they were derived, and make some remarks along those lines. Now, in the case of a population of young clusters like this, where there's a large spread in the ages, we have to distinguish between the luminosity function of the clusters and the mass function, because the clusters, as they're fading, change their luminosities even if they don't change their masses. And so the way that diagram there was derived, that mass function, was to use multicolor photometry of the clusters in the antennae in comparison with stellar population synthesis models to estimate at least crudely the ages of each of the clusters. And so what's plotted here is the log of the luminosities of the clusters versus their ages. And then for reference, these lines here are the lines that you would get for a population of constant mass just fading by the stellar evolution of the population itself. And so the difference between a mass function and a luminosity function, I think, is illustrated very clearly here. If you were forming a luminosity function, you would just project all of these down onto the luminosity axis here and count them up going down this direction. But if we want to form a mass function, then we have to do the counting at a different angle in this diagram. We count the number of clusters above these fading lines here. And because the fading is so strong and because the age range is so wide, you can see there can be substantial differences between a mass function and a luminosity function. And of course, it's the mass function which by far is the most fundamental property of the clusters and the one most likely related to the way in which the clusters form and dissolve. So on this diagram here now, I'd like to put some reference power laws to give you some perspective in these diagrams here. This function here, which evidently has no significant feature in it over this observed range from 10 to the 4th to 10 to the 6th solar masses, can be fitted by this m to the mass to the minus 2 function. The function for the old globular clusters in the Milky Way can be compared to power laws at both the high and the low mass end. Now, it's traditional to fit this function with a log normal distribution. That's indicated by the dashed line. And what you see is that may be a good fit at the bright end, but not very good at the faint end. What's happened here is that since the log normal function was introduced as a fitting function, many more faint clusters have been found and have filled in this part of the diagram here. So in fact, on the faint side of the peak here, the function doesn't fall down like a log normal function at all. This, for reference, is a line corresponding to the number of clusters per unit mass equal to a constant, which corresponds to the number of clusters per unit log mass rising as one power of the mass. Because this is sometimes taken as a possible initial conditions for the evolution of the cluster populations, and because it's fitted by m to the minus 2, it's of interest to ask whether the bright end of this function could also be fitted by an m to the minus 2 power law. And that's illustrated here. Now what you see is that this function tends to fall down faster than m to the minus 2 in this diagram. But that's largely based on these two bins here. This one has one object in it and this has three, for a total of four objects brighter than this line here. On the other hand, there are no clusters more massive than this one here. And so we can ask the question, what would be the expected number if this power law were to continue indefinitely? Now, we don't know that it should for any reason. The basis for this m to the minus 2 comes from a diagram like this, which only extends up to about 10 to the 6th solar masses. But if we did extrapolate it to arbitrarily high masses, we could ask then, what number of clusters would we expect to find more massive than this line here, where this function touches the data here at this tangent point? And the answer is about 12. So we've seen four objects brighter than this line, and we expect about 12, and from Poisson statistics, that's about a 2.5 sigma result. So the point came up earlier in the meeting about whether or not we had to find a physical explanation for this or not, and unfortunately, with a 2.5 sigma result, the answer is we don't know. That may or may not be significant. So it would be interesting to add up the populations of star clusters in many more galaxies to see, to do a similar test and to determine whether that's a significant fall down with respect to this m to the minus 2 reference function. But I emphasize again, we have no strong reason for expecting to extrapolate that to very large masses anyway. Now, this function here was derived, by the way, by simply assuming that the clusters all have about the same mass-to-light ratio, 3 in this case. And this becomes then essentially the luminosity function translated down the mass axis by the mass-to-light ratio appropriate for a population about 10 to the 12 years, about 12 giga-years old. And that's a reasonable thing to do because the relative age spread in this population here is small compared to the mean age of the clusters. But that's not true here. And that leads to that large difference, potential difference between the mass and the luminosity functions. And just to really hammer that point home a little bit further, because there's a tendency in the observational community, I think, to treat mass and luminosity functions as if they're more or less the same thing, even for young populations of clusters. Let me just show you that this is potentially a very dangerous thing to do. In general, if you have a population of clusters forming with different masses and at different ages, then with a rate, say, n dot, a function of mass and age tau into the past, then the luminosity function, the number of clusters per unit luminosity you see, depends on that and also the way in which the clusters have faded since the time they were formed. Between the time they were formed and the time you observe them today. And to take an example that's not too crazy, just to illustrate how dangerous this can be to assume that this function here and this function are the same, let me give you an example. Suppose we take a hypothetical case of a cluster population in which all the clusters form with exactly the same mass. So we have a delta function mass, m0, and they form at a constant rate, okay? Well, the fading then of the clusters, their light to mass ratio will fall down with time roughly as t to the minus 0.8 here. And so that means that the clusters that were formed very recently will have high luminosities, and those that formed a long time ago will have low luminosities. And because this is a power law, the luminosity function will also be a power law. And if you put these functions in there, you'll find that the luminosity function, even though the mass function is a pure delta function, the luminosity function will have a power law L to the minus 2.2, very close to what's observed. So if you see a luminosity function that falls down as L to the minus 2, like most of those observed do, it's not correct to assume that the mass function falls down as M to the minus 2. Exactly. But the point is that there's a strong advantage to trying to get that age information and try and estimate the masses of individual clusters. Okay, you can go terribly wrong, as this example shows, in assuming that you can just replace L with M in functions like this. Well, that's further complication. It could depend on metallicity and IMF and so on and so forth. So, but even not taking that into account, there's this very strong ambiguity. Okay. Now let me just say a few words about formation before I come on to disruption. This is the luminosity function, the CO luminosity function of molecular clouds in the Milky Way, some fairly recent work by Hare et al. And what you see here is this beautiful power law which stretches from about 1,000 solar masses up to about 1,000,000 solar masses in the molecular cloud mass spectrum with a slope of about m to the minus 1.8. And so there's a very good bet that this is somehow related to the power law mass function that we see for young star clusters. And in fact, this was the point of Bruce Elmagreen's talk here. The fact that the mass function of cluster, if we're talking about the clusters in the antennae on the one hand and the molecular clouds in the Milky Way, it would be nice to see the molecular cloud mass spectrum in the antennae, which we can't see because of resolution issues. But in any case, there's a good conjecture that these are closely related. And so then the question becomes, why does the mass function of molecular clouds have roughly this m to the minus 2 or 1.8 spectral index here? And Bruce has made the very important point that this is probably a reflection in some way or other of an underlying fractal distribution, scale-free distribution in the density and other properties of the interstellar medium. But I think what we don't yet understand, or at least what I don't yet understand, is exactly what are the physical processes that determine what that fractal dimension, and therefore this power law index, should be. Or to put it another way, why is the answer m to the minus 2 rather than m to the minus 1 or m to the minus 3? It's fairly clear that one power law will beget another in a fractal like this, but the particular index, I think, is something that we'd like to understand in a simpler and more intuitive way. So this is clearly a fruitful direction for thinking about this kind of problem, but I at least feel that there's still some further understanding that we need to obtain. In particular, it would be interesting to know whether this dimension here should be the same independent of energy injection rates or pressures or vorticity, metallicity, and so forth and so on. I think that's very important when we talk about particularly formation of clusters in young systems. The ones we observe today are almost always metal rich. They exist, in the case of the antennae, in a special sort of state, which may or may not be the same as mergers and the formation of clusters much earlier in the universe. Okay, so getting back to this diagram here, I think what this is telling us is that at least at recent times there's no scale in the problem that sets the physics for the formation of young star clusters. Assuming that other galaxies today are like the antennae, whereas there is a preferred feature in the mass function of old globular clusters. And so there are basically two options. One is these things formed in different ways, the physics in this case having no scale over this mass range. The other case being that it does for older objects, perhaps early in the universe when the metallicity was low and so forth. Or it could be that a function like this will evolve by dynamical effects into one like this. And this presents us with a very well-defined problem to solve, which is to write down the evolution equations for the evolution of the mass function of a system of clusters orbiting around within a host galaxy, starting with some initial mass function like this and some initial distribution function for the orbits, and then evolving this in time to see if it evolves into something like this. And this is the motivation for some work that Cheng Zhang and I did recently, already been mentioned. What we did was to solve an idealized problem in which we feed in basically the known physics of the disruption of clusters by stellar mass loss. As the clusters lose mass, they'll expand, and in a tidal field, they'll lose some of their stars as a result of that. The main effect that's important, as we'll see, is two-body relaxation. Stars are evaporated from the cluster as a result of two-body relaxation, gravitational shocks, and all of this in the context of the tidal field of the galaxy. So in these calculations, we assume that we have a static, spherical, logarithmic gravitational potential, and that clusters are orbiting within this with some assigned distribution function, which specifies how radial or tangential their orbits are, what the populations of different orbits are, and with an initial mass function, to see whether, starting with an initial power law or some other function, we could end up with a function like the one that's observed for the old clusters in the Milky Way. And I don't have time to go into all the details of these calculations, but let me show you some of the results that have come out. This again is the log of the number of clusters per unit log mass versus the log of the mass. What's plotted here is the function evolved at four different times. Well, the initial function here, t equals zero, at 1.5 gigayears later, 3 gigayears later, 6 and 12, so doubling the time in each case. The histograms here are the data for the Milky Way, the same data that I showed you earlier. Then what's shown here in the four different panels are the results for four different initial conditions. One for a power law initial mass function like this. One for a power law but truncated with no masses below 3 times 10 to the fifth solar masses. One that rolls over a little bit like this to fit the high mass end a little bit better. And one, a log normal function from the beginning. And then in these particular panels, what I'm showing you is the result of the mass function averaged over all radii. So it's the total mass function, not segregated according to radius. And what you see here is that first, the striking result that in all cases, the peak of the mass function comes out to be just about the right place, about 2 times 10 to the fifth solar masses. And they're essentially, there's no sort of adjustment of parameters that gives rise to that result here. The second result you see is that at the low mass end of these mass functions, the shape is just about right. And in fact, this function here is rising up in all cases, whether there's a population of low mass clusters initially or not. At later times, this is filled in with a mass function that, in this representation here, rises as m to the minus 1. But remember, that corresponds to the number of clusters per unit mass equal to a constant here. And that's a direct consequence of the fact that in almost all these evolutionary cases, the result of evaporation by two-body relaxation is to drive the masses of individual clusters to zero linearly with time. So these clusters, once evaporation becomes the dominant destruction mechanism, evaporation by two-body relaxation, then clusters essentially move down this axis here at a constant rate. So they spend equal amounts of time in equal mass intervals, and that's what gives rise to this function here being a constant. At the high mass end, the clusters are mainly affected by disruption, by gravitational shocks, although we find that's an especially weak effect. In fact, the gravitational shock effect is not very important, and it never changes the typical mass of clusters by more than a factor of two or so. Most of this effect here is the result of mass loss by stellar evolution, in fact. Now, these models don't include dynamical friction. Dynamical friction would also tend to remove high mass clusters here. That's especially going to be an important effect in low mass galaxies, dwarf galaxies. It turns out that the dynamical friction rates have a very strong inverse dependence on the velocity dispersion of the galaxy. by the time you get up to galaxies like the Milky Way, it's not a terribly important effect. And for giant galaxies like M87, it's virtually negligible, except in the very, very inner parts of the galaxy. So dynamical friction could change this somewhat, and I think Enrico's going to talk about that in the next talk. But in any case, there, for simplicity, that effect is not in these calculations. So one of the main issues that's always concerned me in this problem has been the difficulty of understanding why the mass function of old globular clusters is so similar from one galaxy to another and at different radii within galaxies. And that problem is illustrated here. If disruption is the primary reason for having the peak at a few times 10 to the fifth solar masses. And the reason for that is that if disruption is the primary mechanism for forming that peak in the mass function, then you might have expected that to be a strong function of position within a galaxy and vary from one galaxy to another. So in fact, one of the main motivations for these models that I just showed you was to try to understand whether, in fact, there would be a strong radial variation in the mass function. There are naive reasons for thinking that there should be. This shows in the mass, half-mass radius plane for globular clusters, the regions in which the clusters can survive. They have long time scales for these various disruptive processes versus the regions in which they have time scales shorter than the Hubble time, that is outside of these closed triangles here. So this is the so-called survival triangle, and it's drawn here for clusters at different radii within a galaxy. And the concern here, you see, is that this allowed region is a strong function of radius within a galaxy. But this is derived assuming that the clusters are essentially affected by disruption at the radii where you see them. But that's an oversimplification because as the clusters travel in and out in radius within the galaxy, their density is set mainly by the tidal field at the pericenter of their orbit. And their density determines their two-body relaxation rate and hence the rate at which they evaporate by that process and hence the rate at which that mass function turns over. So there's at least the chance that the radial variations that the clusters experience in their orbits will blur out these strong distinctions that you see here. That was one of the main motivations for performing these simulations. And to make a long story short, what we found was that not all distribution functions for the clusters would work in this sense. What's shown here, thanks, is the result for the clusters in the inner 5 kiloparsecs, the inner half of the clusters and the outer half of the clusters, the observations split in the same way, and then the models in the inner and the outer parts. And for a distribution function in which there's a strong a radial anisotropy which increases outward within the galaxy, then it turns out the distribution of pericenters in this particular distribution function is relatively narrow. Therefore, the range of disruption rates is smaller. And the peak mass in the inner and the outer parts of the galaxy is very, very similar. In fact, compatible with observations in this particular case. But there are other distribution functions. For example, if you put all the clusters on circular orbits or isotropic orbits, in which you would see a significant difference here, one that would be inconsistent with observations. So that's one of the things we learned from these simulations, these models, was under what conditions the mass function would have a weak variation within a galaxy or from one galaxy to another. So let me try to summarize the result we think we've learned from these simulations. First, the peak and the low mass shape of the mass function agree with observations for almost any initial mass function and any initial distribution function. There are essentially no free parameters. There are a few theoretic parameters that are theoretically uncertain at the factor 50% level, but they're not really adjustable over a wide range. The radial variation of the mass function does depend on the initial position velocity distribution function. You can get agreement with the observations in the Milky Way if you have a distribution function which is more isotropic in the inner regions and more anisotropic in the outer regions of the galaxy. However, some initial distribution functions don't work, circuit orbits being one of them, isotropic orbits, even scale-free distribution functions don't work. I think Enrico is going to talk more about this. However, remember these models are idealized. They consider the galaxy to be a static, spherically symmetric system over its whole lifetime. And the results that come about here come about because essentially of the distribution of the pericenters of the clusters, which determines essentially the distribution of their densities. But in a real galaxy, the potential won't be exactly spherical, and so the clusters won't always return to the same pericenter. Furthermore, if there's merging during the lifetime of the galaxy, if there's any kind of violent relaxation, then the orbits of the clusters in the inner parts of the galaxy and the outer parts of the galaxy will be scrambled, and their mass functions for the inner and the outer clusters will be averaged or mixed, and the gradient in the peak of the mass function will be diluted. Exactly how important that is, we don't know, but it's clear that these models and the differences in the peak of the mass function that they give are a worst-case scenario. The other modification, the more realistic that you would make this, the more similar the mass functions would be. Okay, another thing I didn't have time to say is that there should be essentially a weak or no dependence of the globular cluster mass function on the circular, on the properties of the parent galaxy, provided the galaxies obey a scaling relation which has which obeys has the baryonic, the slope of the baryonic Tully-Fisher relation that you expect in cold dark matter type models. Okay, some implications of this and other calculations that deal with the disruption of star clusters. The peak mass always increases with age, at least for any initial function that's monotonically decreasing. That's potentially observable, as has been mentioned earlier in the meeting. The peak mass decreases with galactocentric radius. Part of the goal was to understand how to make that effect as small as possible, but it can't go away entirely to zero, and so it should, in principle, be observable. It's difficult to do because you're counting star clusters against a variable background as you go out in radius in a galaxy. Many field spheroid stars could be the debris of disrupted clusters. The exact fraction isn't known because we don't know how far the mass function extends down or with what slope to very, very low masses. If you extend it down to a solar mass with an m to the minus 2 spectrum, then you won't explain the entire spheroid of the Milky Way by disrupted star clusters. The mass function would have to go steeper than that between about 1 and 10 to the 4 solar masses, and then you could do it. Another important result is that any feature in the initial mass function, say a gene's mass cutoff or so, that would be destroyed by this disruption mechanism. That would be erased. Remember, that low mass tail of the mass function is filled in by clusters that started above that and are losing mass and then drifting down below the cutoff. So if there were any signature of the initial formation processes in the low mass part of the mass function, that would be destroyed and gone, and basically not recoverable by observing older populations of clusters. The basic characteristic mass scale in this problem looks like it's well explained simply by the idea that low mass clusters are removed, and the peak is then determined physically. The physics of that peak is determined by the condition that the disruption time scale, mainly by two-body evaporation, be roughly equal to the age of the system. My last view graph. There are plenty of remaining issues, but let me just mention one of them. There may be a problem understanding the high mass end of the mass function. As I mentioned earlier, there's with a very low statistical significance, there's some indication that it drops down faster than a power law. If that's true, that requires some physical explanation. My guess is that this may be related to a problem in galaxy formation having to do with the fact that models like CDM predict too many small structures like dwarf galaxies compared to the observations. And so solving that problem may end up solving this problem again in the transition region between star clusters and dwarf galaxies. There's also the question of what were the initial distribution functions in galaxies, and are they consistent with the distribution functions that we know we need now to have this this peak in the mass function that depends relatively weakly on position within the galaxies. And of course, in the future, we'll have better observations from NGST, HST, and so forth. I think it'd be very important to focus observationally on some of these intermediate age cluster systems. It's going to be very important to get ages, though, as I've tried to emphasize. It'd be very important then to study the mass distribution in as many different kinds of galaxies as possible and with as many different ages as possible to try and guide or constrain these types of ideas. Okay, thanks.
In this kind of very ambitious study where you want to develop a complete theoretical picture for how an entire system of global clusters evolves in a galaxy, you didn't say much about how exactly you did this, but the number of free parameters must be frightening. I mean, all the parameters describing the individual cluster initial conditions, plus all the parameters describing the initial conditions of the system in the galaxy, plus all the rather uncertain physics of the disruption processes, especially things like tidal shocking, which is really not that well understood theoretically. So there must be kind of uncertain or free parameters that you put into your recipes for how you treat that. I'm almost surprised that you can conclude anything in the end that's really robust. So can you say a little bit more about what parameters you varied, what assumptions you just adopted, and how, you know, how strong is the conclusion?
Okay. Well, the initial conditions, the initial mass function and the initial distribution function are things you feed into these calculations. And that's part of the point of the calculations, is to see how much the final results depend on those. And that's what I showed you here. And the conclusion there is that the position of the peak is relatively insensitive to the shape of the initial mass function or to the initial distribution function. That we learned from these calculations anyway. However, there are things like the radial variations that depend on that, and the idea was to quantify that. The great simplification that occurs in all of this is that primarily, it turns out that the main disruption process is evaporation by two-body relaxation of a cluster confined by the tidal field of the parent galaxy. Disk shocks and bulge shocks are a relatively small effect, so there are theoretical uncertainties in exactly how to treat those, but it turns out they're a very small effect on these sorts of things. Dynamical friction, similarly, is also a complex problem, especially when you talk about clusters that are not on circuit orbits. But as I've emphasized here, in high-mass galaxies, that's a relatively small effect, except maybe right in the very center of the galaxy. So the real question then comes down to how well do we understand evaporation of escape of stars as a result of evaporation by two-body effects within a tidally limited star cluster. And there have been many, many, many simulations of this, and they all show very, very complicated behavior of the core region, depending on how many binaries are involved, what the mass function is of the stars, what the velocity anisotropy is, and so on and so forth. But they almost always give a linear dependence of the mass on time. You've seen many of these diagrams that show the core going like this all over the diagram. But when people plot mass versus time, and this is the result of n-body simulations, Fokker-Planck, gas sphere calculations, and so on, they almost always show a very nicely linear dependence. And then the only question is, what is the slope of that relation and how well known is that? And what you find in the literature over extreme ranges in all of these parameters is factors of two or so. And it's that rate that determines the actual peak. So I would say that the shape of the mass function and its form at low masses is a consequence of this linear dependence of the mass with time of clusters. And I think that's fairly robust. The peak, I think, is known to within about 50%, because I think we know this escape parameter over a wide range of conditions within the cluster at that level of accuracy. That's the same level of accuracy to which we know the mass-to-light ratio that we need to convert the peak in the luminosity function to the peak in the mass function anyway. So it is true that this is an ambitious calculation, but I think actually we've been able to isolate the key features of it. Now, there will be details that will change. There's no doubt about that. But I think actually I feel quite good that we do understand the main features of how this works now. Well, that's in the models, and that has that what all the models agree that that gives, well, again, it depends on the IMF and so forth. That has an important effect, potentially important effect, on high mass clusters only at early times, and early means less than a gigayear. After a star population has been around a gigayear, it's not losing any more mass. And so all the late time evolution is insensitive to that. Everything relaxes away from that completely. But the first gigayear of this, I would say that there are uncertainties in the first gigayear of the evolution of these systems as a result of effects that are not included here. And I think Enrico will talk about that in just a minute. And that is, it's assumed in these calculations, to simplify the analysis, that the cluster is Roche filling from the beginning of the calculation. Now, clusters may or may not, they may have overfilled their Roche surfaces, they may have underfilled them. Eventually they will grow to fill them. If they extended beyond them, they lose the part that extends beyond, and if they're inside that, they'll lose enough mass to expand out and reach it. So eventually they'll get there and these calculations will apply. But there could be details like that that change the evolution over the initial gigayear or so. So the results that I present, that summarized for you on these view graphs, I do feel are fairly robust results that are going to be independent of the details of more refined input physics into these calculations.
You showed us four initial mass functions for our galaxy, mm-hmm. and then you showed the evolution of those mass functions. Mm-hmm. In these four cases, maybe you can bring the slide up again, mm-hmm. how many globular clusters that originally had a mass of, say, let's take 10 to the 100,000 solar masses, how many of those in those four different cases have disappeared? The reason why this may be important for X-ray people is that this would put an upper limit on the maximum bright low mass X-ray binaries that mm-hmm. are no longer in globular clusters but may have been formed in globular clusters.
And more generally, the question has come up of to what extent the whole field spheroid population in a galaxy like the Milky Way could have formed in disrupted clusters. So I think you can see from this diagram that the answer varies a lot depending on what the initial function is. In this case here, for example, I'm thinking in terms of mass now, which probably corresponds roughly to numbers of stars. Okay, so I'm not thinking about numbers of clusters, but roughly, I think, as if I recall, something like 2/3 of the mass in this initial function is gone by the time you get to this one here, okay? Something like that. And so basically, you know, the stars that weren't, you know, so they're, okay. In this case here, because it's a power law, there can be a lot more mass in the low mass tail. And this, so if we extrapolate this, say, down to a solar mass, then my recollection is that we get about 10 times as much mass in the initial distribution as in the final one, 10 times, whereas there's about 100 times as many field spheroid stars in the Milky Way as there are stars in currently bound globular clusters. So just extrapolating this power law, even in this most optimistic case, down to one solar mass, wouldn't explain the entire field spheroid population. Now, it would if this function went steeper, farther down, but we have no reason to suppose that. Unfortunately, it depends a lot on that power law.
Okay, last question.
So I completely agree about the intermediate age ones being important testing grounds for these models. And I think they're also somewhat easier observationally, because this issue of the conversion from mass to light in terms of the function, that problem pretty much goes away, because what matters is the age of the population compared to the duration of the burst. And there, they're much older than the span of time in which the clusters were formed. So the variations you described, which are extremely important for the youngest systems, become not very, very important for the intermediate age systems.
Well, if I could just respond to that, it may turn out that you're right. However, I would personally like to see that verified observation. In other words, I would like people actually to measure the ages of the clusters and find out whether the delta T over T for that population, you're assuming that it's much less than 1, in which case you can convert a luminosity function to a mass function. I would like people actually to go out and see if that's true. For a giga-year-old population, that may not be true.
You can do it to the level the observations allow you to determine a relative age. And in that case, for even the giga-year-old population, for some of the galaxies Francois Schweitzer showed earlier, it's true. But there is an error bar, and maybe we should include the error bar, and that's probably what it comes down to.
There's a reason I'm going on about, partly is that if there is a spread, then there's enough fading from the youngest to the oldest clusters that when you start to compare in detail the predictions of a theory for the mass function with a luminosity function, you can get into trouble.
Okay, I think we should move on. Sorry.